Support for this podcast comes from ESIX. For 25 years, ESIX has been the preeminent peer networking and independent information source for corporate executive recruiting leaders worldwide. Featuring members from around 100 of the leading employers in the world, it is the one-stop shop for trusted networking with peers, for benchmarking, and for team development. Find out more about membership at www.esix.org. That's www.esix.org, and ESIX is spelled E-S-I-X, or buy their book, Leadership Recruiting, on Amazon.
There's been more of scientific discovery, more of technical advancement and material progress in your lifetime and mine than in all the ages of history.
Hi everyone, this is Matt Alder. Welcome to episode 365 of the Recruiting Future podcast. One of the topics I get asked to cover frequently is the growth of the corporate executive recruiting function. So with that in mind, I've partnered with ESIX, the Executive Search Information Exchange, to bring you a series of three interviews exploring the key trends and issues in corporate executive recruiting. In the previous two episodes, we looked at the evolution of corporate executive recruiting and what employers should be doing to improve the diversity of their executive teams. For the final interview in this short series, I'm talking to Eric Goldstein, Global Head of Executive Talent Attraction at SAP. We discuss how long-term talent engagement is starting to play a bigger role in executive recruiting, the growth of data-driven decision-making, and what the future might look like. Hi, Eric, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Matt. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
An absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Could you just introduce yourself and tell us what you do?
Absolutely. It would be my pleasure. First, my name is Eric Goldstein, and I've been in executive search for more than 20 years. I'm now the global head of executive talent attraction at SAP. And I've just completed my first 3 weeks with SAP and had previously been with IBM, where I headed the executive recruitment as well as the onboarding and integration function for the enterprise at IBM. Prior to that, I ran a practice at Korn Ferry. It was a financial services practice focused on the mid-level professional they call professional search. And then prior to that, I had a different career in finance and actually started my career as a certified public accountant with Coopers & Lybrand, now known as PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Fantastic stuff. And huge congratulations on the new job.
Thank you. Thank you. So far, so good. You know, there's a bit of a learning curve and a knowledge transfer process that's happening, but it's really great fun. And it's a great organization and enterprise, wonderful people.
So obviously we've been through and are going through a very disruptive period. How sort of generally has that affected the talent market for the executive function?
Well, I think this may be true in other industries as well, but particularly in technology, it's a hyper-competitive marketplace. And, you know, unlike some other industries, the global pandemic actually accelerated demand throughout the process as more companies in every industry had to accelerate their digital transformations because everybody was relying on online service delivery. And that really accelerated the process that was going to occur anyway over the next several years, but now is really happening at a super high velocity. So it's been, I think it just elevated the importance of the function and the mission critical nature of executive search, both from an in-house perspective, as well as from a outside search firm perspective as well.
Now, I know that a big focus for you is long-term proactive engagement of talent. Could you tell us a little bit about what you mean by that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I see this as really a top trend in the industry, as well as in other industries also, as the marketplace becomes more competitive. And there's a realization that cycle times, you know, which is typically 90 days from beginning, commencing a search, till the successful candidate accepts his or her offer. It's traditionally 90 days, whether you go to a Korn Ferry or a Heidrick or a Spencer Stuart or Russell Reynolds, so on and so forth, or from a corporate in-house experience as well. And there's a realization that you're not always going to get the best talent, both from a technical fit perspective, a cultural fit perspective, as well as a diversity perspective in that 90-day window of time. Again, when I was recruited to SAP, it was just a moment in time where I was vulnerable to the approach, or receptive to the approach is probably a better word. And then we obviously went through a process where I became acquainted, you know, with the enterprise. Now, if you get in front of that cycle, in terms of acquainting passive executive talent with the value proposition of your enterprise in advance of a need or a requisition, you have an opportunity to really shorten the cycle time and improve the scope of candidates that you would consider, obviously elevating diversity, cultural folks that may be, you know, a better cultural fit as well as a better technical fit. So it's basically engaging with passive talent in advance of a need and having a meaningful dialogue with that individual that's programmatic and sustainable, and actually introducing that talent to executives so they can get to know the enterprise and the executives and vice versa. And so when there is a need, there's already a relationship that's present.
Talk a little bit more about how that's scalable and how that might be a kind of an ongoing strategy rather than something just for one particular role.
Absolutely. So listen, I think that that's the biggest challenge. The fact that you can't court, you know, an unlimited number of senior executive candidates and provide a delightful experience where it's going to reflect well on your employer brand. So the only way that I figured out to do this is to really be selective into those that you engage with and then have a quick offboarding, you know, program if it's clearly not a potential fit for the future. So it starts with kind of the targeting and those individuals that you targeted and being really precision oriented as best as you can in terms of their background and their experiences. And obviously you can do some anecdotal diligence on these individuals. And then once you decide who you're going to reach out to, you really have to have a meaningful dialogue with that individual. It's not, hey, would you be open to a conversation type of an approach? It's, hey, I'm really impressed with your background. You know, here's what we're doing at SAP. Love to trade notes with you. Might there be any interest in, you know, engaging, you know, just having an open-ended dialogue, you know, with our executive in this specific area and with no strings, you know, and no attachments. But again, there needs to be a quid pro quo, an exchange of information, market information, obviously nothing that's sensitive or confidential, but generally there needs to be a quid pro quo for a passive candidate who's quite busy to be able to have the appetite to engage in this dialogue.
Obviously, that's a departure from, as you were saying, the sort of traditional 90-day search and hiring cycle in executive research. How do you manage expectations around that, both in terms of the prospective employee, but also the hiring managers as well?
Well, I think it's harder for the hiring managers, believe it or not, from an enablement perspective, Matt. You know, the first challenge really is to define what is expected of the hiring manager in terms of investment of time. They are going to be required for this to be successful to devote the time from their busy schedules to have regular touch points. And, you know, and it, again, it varies from candidate to candidate, situation to situation, but there needs to be consistency and sustainability because what's happened in the past, and again, this has been a very agile process and we've learned, you know, in terms of how best to do this. And we're still making adjustments. We certainly haven't cracked the code yet entirely, but we're making good incremental progress. So first, having the person, agree to meet, but ideally in person post-pandemic, with the individual, just have a, casual lunch or coffee with that person if they're local, or a video conference if they're not. And then, agree, if there's a potential alignment mutually and it makes sense to carry on the conversation, and there's no immediate open role that makes sense, agree to have a 30 or 60 day checkpoint, with that individual. And, from the recruiting standpoint, we'll give digital nudges to those hiring managers or senior executives to say, hey, you haven't spoken to this individual, 90 days have passed. It's probably a good idea just to have a touch-based conversation, just to reaffirm the fact that there is interest in maintaining and cultivating the relationship. On the prospect side, it's a little easier, because once they agree to an open-ended conversation, as long as it's understood, they understand that there's no strings, that confidentiality is completely assured. We're not going to be checking them out in the marketplace and understanding. So we won't, in other words, be putting them at risk. So it's a riskless proposition on their side. And they're just there with no, with no expectations about a potential job or specific role, but rather for them to learn something about, the enterprise and, what we're doing and what, how we're trying to drive our strategy.
In the other conversations that I've been having about executive research, one of the other topics that's come up is the growth of data-driven assessment and selection. Can you sort of talk us through your experience with that and what it entails?
Absolutely. I think the holy grail, Matt, is to, find a fully objective, unbiased way to evaluate candidates for selection. As we know, intuition plays a pretty significant role, particularly amongst the recruiters themselves, but also, the hiring stakeholders. Everybody seems to know what good looks like, what works best, what type of background works best, what types of traits and competencies the person will bring to the role to ultimately be successful. But nothing is documented and nothing is data-driven or data-based. So we're trying to kind of introduce some science to it, have a success profile that's based on a successful exemplar at the enterprise. Understanding what that individual's background consists of from an experiential perspective, and also the softer skills, what is that personality's, what is the personality of that individual? What traits do they exhibit? What natural tendencies do they exhibit? So on and so forth. So having it be much more scientific in that regard. So we really, there's alignment amongst all the stakeholders in terms of what good looks like. And it's generally accepted, so we can make a decision against that for specific candidates or prospects. In addition to success profiles, the two other tools that we're using are psychometric assessments and essentially, just getting more insight in terms of their personalities. Now, this is not a magic bullet, so training and enablement is really important amongst the hiring stakeholders. This will just give us further insight in terms of the person's natural tendencies and where they're expending extra energy to be successful versus the success profile. It's not going to be a determinant ultimately if they're a perfect fit for the role or not. Again, it's just another data point amongst many. And then lastly, a behavioral interview guide. Obviously, in most companies, as an SAP, there's several stakeholders involved in terms of, interviewing for cultural fit, for technical fit, so on and so forth. And you could have, 5 to 7 generally interviewers in a typical process. You certainly don't want more than, 10 because then the experience is going to be compromised ultimately, and there's going to be a lot of redundancy in the questions. But for the candidate to have the best experience and the hiring stakeholders to glean the most best information, there has to be a really effective feedback loop. So there needs to be a guide, a behavioral interview guide, where you're avoiding redundancy in questioning and you're triangulating on any areas of concern, and where interviewer, has a potential concern in a specific area, he or she is communicating that to interviewer B and C to triangulate on those areas and conduct more diligence around those areas.
Some of the things that you're talking about there are things that have been used in other areas of recruitment, perhaps for a while, maybe not in quite the same way. Why is it that executive recruitment hasn't done this in the past, if you see what I mean?
Listen, I think there's a whole host of reasons, but I think that the biggest one I think you'll find if you were to conduct a survey is just capacity and time constraints. A lot of recruiters have a lot of open recs on their plate, their collective plates, and just don't have time to put in a standard process, kind of linking all of these elements into one comprehensive program. And, historically, I think, recruiters like to operate in an autonomous, fashion and deliver a very bespoke experience depending upon the hiring manager they're working with, as well as the type of position that they're recruiting for. So I think it's a combination of those two factors as to why there's not more standardization and harmonization of these methods and tools.
How are they improving hiring outcomes?
Well, essentially, that remains to be seen, Matt. So I think it's going to require a measurement, a look-back measurement that not a lot of companies are doing. And I refer to it as a quality of hire measure, where you're looking back 6 months from the time of placement and understanding whether or not that person, first of all, is integrating well and is adding value and is meeting his or her, KPIs. And then looking back a year and 2 years down the line. And in a sales capacity, this is kind of easy because it's really quantitative. In measure, you could see if they're meeting their sales targets and quotas. But for, a general management type of role, it may be a little bit more difficult, and there's qualitative measures, things like asking the hiring manager if he or she would hire that person again, doing a 360-degree survey, looking at engagement survey if this person is a people manager, and having the right measures to really understanding if this hire had impact. And, a measure that I see used quite often is attrition. Has the person been retained? Is the person still there after 2 years' time or 3 years' time? And to me, that's not, it's a measure, but it's not the ideal measure because it doesn't indicate if this person really has conveyed value, to the enterprise or not. So I like to see kind of outcome-oriented measures, things that are objective and easy to measure, and really data-driven and science-based.
And how do you account for the external variables there? Because people at this level, I'm sure their performance is sort of particularly susceptible to the support they get from the enterprise, the dynamics of the market, all those kind of things. How do you take that into account?
It's really difficult because it does take a village, So the executive recruiter that, ultimately identifies, assesses, and recruits the successful candidate certainly doesn't have influence over the person's ability to be successful in an enterprise. Like you said, that is a function of, market dynamics. It's a function of, are they getting the proper support from the hirings, from their teams and a direct manager. So I think there's a lot of external forces at play, like you suggest. So, my advice is, reminding everybody that everybody is accountable for their successful hire, including, the onboarding and integration function. And they need to set the person up for success from the get-go, really help the person integrate well into the organization, help them feel supported, and make it part of the KPIs of the manager and others to ensure the success of that individual. So I'm a big fan of documenting hiring decisions. Having a document that shows that I voted to hire this person and I am committed to the person's success. So if they derail or something, there's a sense of accountability there. And it's not just the fault of the recruiter, because I've heard too many times, your fault, that the person wasn't successful and didn't integrate into the company successfully, so on and so forth. So I think it's really important to remind everybody during the enablement period that it's everybody's collective responsibility to ensure the success of the hire.
A bit earlier in the conversation, you talked about improving diversity. And obviously that's been a challenge for a while at the executive level. What's the solution to the challenge when it comes to attracting and hiring more diverse executive talent?
I don't claim to know the absolute solution. There certainly is no magic bullet. And it is a hyper-competitive marketplace for diverse talent. Globally, from a gender diversity perspective, I think in the US, in the Americas, from an underrepresented minority perspective, in the UK, from a BAME perspective. So everybody defines, diverse hires, in a different way, but gender diversity seems to be the universally accepted one across the globe. But again, there's no magic bullet, but there are some best practices. And I think the first best practice is really to try to pipeline that talent. Start early conversations with that talent, as we were talking about at the outset of our conversation. Also being really empathetic to that individual. First of all, they're being called upon by so many companies now with what's going on in the U.S. and the hunger and the appetite for the diverse talent to achieve their business objectives. There's a wholesale recognition that it does require the most diverse talent to be successful. So everybody is chasing that talent, and you don't want to leave the individual with the person that you're calling on that person because of his or because of their gender or ethnicity or race. But you're calling on them because you're interested, in their skills and their competencies. And I think it's really, really important that comes across really authentically in the approach, as well as the subsequent process and conversations. And then once the person enters into an interviewing process, I think it's really important that there be a diverse interviewer panel, whether or not you're doing sequential interviews or having a panel collectively. Having people that are female or diverse ethnically or racially is really, really important, that they see there are people that look like them that are represented on as decision makers in the organization. And I can't emphasize enough, you can't lead this exercise by spreadsheet. I've seen it done in the past where they go to the most granular level, in a division without regard, to whether or not there is a diverse constituency in a highly technical area. If there's no availability of talent, you're not going to be fishing in a pond that's that has a lot of optionality in that talent pool, and the likelihood of you coming to a diverse outcome is very low. So, obviously you should be really thoughtful and systematic and leverage talent insights and understanding where the most diverse talent pools reside and try to exploit those talent pools.
Are there any sort of lessons you've learned about, tactics that don't work or that people should avoid?
So Matt, in terms of, lessons learned, as it relates to diverse recruiting, I think it pays not to be closed-minded. Again, if if you're going into an area, and let's just, by example, in automotive or industrial, you know, you're not going to find, unfortunately, it's just the market dynamics, you know, a plethora of female talent at the senior executive level. And again, this is just what I've found. I'm not stating that's the absolute fact. However, I think it really, really pays to be cognizant of that reality, and help it inform your development plans for more junior talent and try to grow that talent, you know, in-house rather than beat your head against the wall and trying to recruit for that talent on the outside. Again, managing by spreadsheet, I think, is a pitfall that many fall into. And, you know, recognizing that you really need to take a holistic view toward diversity, and, you know, really try to find those areas, you know, where you're going to gain the traction. It's not a short-term gratification exercise. It's something that requires commitment and investment to the long-term, in terms of both cultivating talent on the in-house side, as well as fishing in the ponds where there's greater volume of talent, you know, in certain areas from a diversity standpoint relative to others.
Final question. What's on your radar for the next 12 to 18 months? What do you think the future is going to look like?
I think the competition for talent at the executive levels is going to intensify. So I think it's going to require, I think that's, first of all, going to elevate the stature of the corporate in-house executive recruitment function, as well as the onboarding and integration function. So I think you're going to see more resources and investment be allocated toward these functions where historically, you know, it was kind of a bolt-on to talent acquisition. I think there's going to be a recognition that this is the key to unlocking a competitive advantage and being competitive because, again, when you refresh talent from the external marketplace, you infuse a different way of thinking, different perspectives, someone that's going to disrupt the status quo, particularly if you have long tenured individuals in your enterprise and you're going through a transformation of sorts and it requires new thinking. So I think you're really going to see that. So I think you're already starting to see recruiters being poached across the board because of that recognition. And I think that's going to intensify. And then again, the proactive kind of predictive working hand in glove with executive succession, functions is going to be much more of the norm rather than this reactive, transactional, rec by rec type of approach that has been the traditional way of thinking as it relates to executive recruitment in the past. I think increasingly it's going to be much more predictive and proactive in nature.
Eric, thank you very much for talking to me.
It's been my pleasure, Matt. Thanks for having me.
My thanks to Eric. If you want to find out more about membership of E6, you can contact Simon Mullins, their CEO, directly via email. His email address is simon@e6.org. You can subscribe to this podcast in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or via your podcasting app of choice. Please also follow the show on Instagram. You can find us by searching for Recruiting Future. You can search all the past episodes at recruitingfuture.com. On that site, you can also subscribe to the mailing list to get the inside track about everything that's coming up on the show. Thanks very much for listening. I'll be back next time, and I hope you'll join me.
This is my show.
How much do you understand the future of finance? I'm Jim Roos, a top 10 banking influencer and host of the podcast Banking Transformed, where we dive deeply into the rapidly evolving world of banking and financial technology. Join me as I interview industry experts, thought leaders, and innovators as they unravel the latest banking trends, disruptions, and game-changing technologies reshaping the world of finance. Redefine your understanding of the banking ecosystem. Subscribe now to Banking Transformed, available wherever you get your podcasts, and now available on YouTube.